Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to another episode of Legal Face Off with Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini, and I'm Ben Anderson, filling in for Sam Panionovich.
Man of many talents. Who knew Ben had such a good radio voice?
Awesome. Awesome radio voice.
I bring it out for, you know, those big boy moments.
That's right. Yeah. Where's Sam, by the way?
Sam's in Vegas.
As you'll hear shortly, Sam is dealing with the fallout of one of these cases right now.
He is.
So we'll get
lawyer in the making.
We'll get to all of that shortly here.
We have a full docket today on Legal Face Off, filled with SCOTUS decisions, legal legacies. Later, we'll have State Representative Lou Lang on and a follow-up segment on the MIT student suicide. And finally, the ever-popular legal grab bag. But first, joining us on the phone is Associate Professor of Law at the Kent College of Law and Co-Director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, Carolyn Shapiro, and author and founder of the EmpiricalScotus.com, Adam Feldman. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
So exciting time. One of our favorite times here on Legal Face Off is when the Supreme Court starts to issue decisions every term. And here we are. We've got two members of our esteemed Supreme Court panel. Let's jump right into it. Carolyn, you are an expert in the Supreme Court, having clerked for Justice Breyer, and you're the former Solicitor General of Illinois. Let's dive into the case getting the most attention, making sports betting legal. Talk to us about that.
So in this case, the statute basically said that the states could, only states that had legalized sports betting at the time that the statute was passed could continue to have legal sports betting, with a couple, sort of a, some minor tweaks to that. And New Jersey wanted to legalize sports betting, and the courts had said, the lower courts had said that it could not, pursuant to the statute. The Supreme Court said, that was beyond Congress's power, because it was telling the states what they could and could not regulate.
Adam, immediately, sports teams owners like Mark Cuban, the CEO of DraftKings was predictably very excited. Lots of people thinking that this will double, triple, maybe more, the value of sports teams in this country.
Yeah, it's a very interesting decision because of the implications, and not only for federal law, but most importantly for state law, that really opens up the door for states to create their own laws regulating sports betting in a way that wasn't possible while the federal statute was on the books. And since the Supreme Court ruled that statute unconstitutional, it really is an immediate process by which states can now move forward and start to regulate their own betting within the states.
Carolyn, it's a victory, as Adam mentioned, for states' rights. Are you surprised by this decision and its granting states rights in this issue, given the current makeup of the Supreme Court?
Well, I'm a little bit surprised in the sense that the decision really has to struggle with distinguishing between what they talk about as the anti-commandeering principle, which is the idea that states can't be told by Congress what to do, and the principle that Congress can pass laws that preempt state laws. And both of those principles are good law, and this particular statute seems to sort of fall right smack on the borderline between them, and I think that there's going to be a lot of confusion going forward about exactly where that line is in some other context. It's going to call into question some preemption doctrine, or at least people will try to claim that it calls into question some preemption doctrine. And many of the justices who signed on to this decision are big fans of preemption. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out.
So let's switch gears and talk about the case of Robert McCoy. The Supreme Court yesterday overturned this Louisiana inmate's death sentence because they found in a 6-3 ruling that he had the fundamental right to make decisions about his defense. This was the case where his lawyer, in the hopes to save his client's life, had actually told the jury that he was guilty, even though McCoy had said and expressly objected to his lawyer's strategy in that regard. Adam, would you like to talk about this?
Yeah, I think the case was quite quite interesting because it really dealt with scope of where an attorney can jump in. So it's not just that the attorney wanted to plead guilty. He wanted to plead guilty to a lesser charge in a case where there was a high likelihood of guilt on the defendant's behalf. And so the issue was whether the attorney could plead guilty to a lesser charge, to which the attorney saw in the best interest of the defendant. And the defendant was interested in pleading not guilty to the greater charge, which could have led to a sentence of death. So really, this case was not only dealing with whether a defendant can plead guilty to a lesser charge, but whether an attorney could choose something that felt that he or she felt was in the defendant's best interest.
And Carolyn, Justice Ginsburg, who wrote the majority, explained that there are certain things in a trial that you can see to your defense attorney, certain things that they called in the decision trial management. For example, what evidence to object to, what arguments to pursue. But the defendant themselves has the sole right to make some decisions, you know, large decisions where the defendant has to be involved, such as whether to plead guilty or to waive the right to a jury trial. What really struck me, though, was the dissent in this case, which basically said the majority didn't quite understand the underlying facts of the case. They said that the defense attorney wasn't saying that his client was guilty, merely that he told the jury that his client had indeed killed the three victims, but was not guilty of first-degree murder because he did not intend to kill them. Those are two very different things.
I think that sort of goes in part to what Adam was just saying, because, in fact, functionally, what the lawyer was saying was that his client was guilty to this lesser offense, some kind of, you know, second-degree murder or manslaughter or whatever it might have been called in that state. And ordinarily, and uncontroversially, defendants do have the right to decide whether or not to plead guilty or not, even where in a situation where their lawyer thinks it's in their best interest to plead guilty and then, you know, try to get some kind of better luck on in the sentencing, which is essentially what was going on here. The decision about whether to plead guilty or not guilty is fundamentally a decision of the defendant. The dissent saw this as in very formal terms, that in fact, no, the lawyer wasn't pleading guilty on behalf of the client, and the majority saw it in very functional terms, in that if in fact either the lawyer was pleading guilty on behalf of the client, or the implications of the factual concessions the lawyer was making were so significant and so fundamentally related to guilt or innocence that it had to be within the scope of the client's power, not the lawyer's.
Seems a little surprising that the lower courts would have consistently found the way they did. I mean, it seems, even from a layman's perspective, that common sense would dictate that the decision whether to plead guilty in a capital murder case must include the defendant. I mean, it just seems like basic common sense, you know, even without knowing a lot of criminal jurisprudence.
Well, I think that is in part why you see this is not a close case, right? It's a 6-3 decision. So obviously some members of the court who are not necessarily particularly inclined to vote in favor of criminal defendants clearly agreed with you.
So our last case is the case involving unauthorized rental car drivers, where there is a search and seizure situation. The case dates back to 2014 when Terrence Byrd was stopped by police for a minor traffic violation. He was asked by police when they said that he seemed to be nervous for the rental agreement for the car. His name was not listed as a permitted driver under that rental car agreement. And then the officer said that they didn't need consent to search his car because his name was not listed on the rental agreement. And as it turns out, when they looked in the car, they found 49 bricks of heroin. So, Adam, would you like to take us through this case and its significance?
Yeah, well, this is significant for several reasons. First, I'd love to give a shout-out to Bob Loeb, who practices for ORIC. This was, I believe, his first oral argument before the Supreme Court, and was victorious in this result. So that was very nice to see. This was a decision by Justice Kennedy, his second decision of the term, and it was somewhat interesting because it seems like Justice Kennedy has been picking up many of the heavily split decisions over the last few years, and I expect that he will many more this term, although this was a unanimous decision. The case itself seems to build upon the court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudence in related areas, like when somebody is not the owner of a property, a physical property like a house or a dwelling, a hotel room, and there still is a reasonable expectation of privacy. The court found similarly here, and it seemed like there was no real quarrel among the justices given the unanimous result, that even when somebody's not listed on the rental car agreement, they still have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and that means that there has to either be a warrant or probable cause to search the property, which they did not have in this case.
Carolyn, what are your thoughts on this case?
Well, what struck me as, it didn't really surprise me all that much that the decision was essentially unanimous. And I think that it makes, people, the actual level of privacy in their cars, or to put another way, the police's ability to search cars or to get a drug dog to sniff cars the police have a lot of ability to search a car when they want to. So this doesn't really, create an enormous loophole in the law. Really, what it for police officers, it simply means they have to treat rental cars the same way as they treat all other cars, regardless of whether the driver is, on the rental agreement or not. What struck me about it was that the Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch, wrote a concurrence where he suggested that perhaps there should be some revisiting of some of the underlying principles of the Fourth Amendment. He said, nobody's asked us to do that, or Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. Nobody's asked us to do that, so, we're not, and so I'm joining this opinion. He raised similar concerns about some what's called severability analysis in the gambling case. That is, what does the court do when it strikes down part of a law as unconstitutional? Should it strike down the whole law? Should it try to preserve part of the law? And so there's a real interesting trend here, at least in these cases, where the Justice Thomas and perhaps Justice Gorsuch are saying, we want to revisit longstanding jurisprudence, longstanding precedent.
All right, last question before we let you go on our Supreme Court panel to lead off Legal Face-Off. Last week, we had the directors of the new documentary RBG on, a great film that was just released about the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is, as you know, a rock star. Have you seen the film? And who do you think would make the subject of a good documentary that's currently on the Supreme Court or a former justice?
Well, I have to admit, I haven't seen the film, although I have a date to see it with my 13-year-old friend and next-door neighbor, so I'm very much looking forward to that as a bat mitzvah present. I think Justice Thomas would be a fascinating documentary. His personal story is extremely interesting and obviously led him to places that many people think are surprising. So I think that would be fascinating.
Surprised you didn't pick Justice Breyer, but that's okay.
Oh, I think Justice Breyer would be great as well, of course.
Adam, what are your thoughts?
Well, I have yet to see the movie. Like Carolyn, it's somewhat child related. I have a 6 month old at home along with two other older kids, and
he can't appreciate the nuances of Supreme Court jurisprudence. I'm shocked.
They don't allow me out of the house very often, aside from working. So I have not had the privilege of seeing it yet. Although I am giving a short course on Ginsburg in the fall that kind of dovetails with the documentary. So that should be interesting. I think Thomas would be a great subject. I also think Justice Sotomayor, for her somewhat outspoken nature, is a really interesting subject. And her history, being the one judge, justice on the court that was on a district court, her experience was a little bit different than the rest of the justices. I think she would be a fascinating subject as well.
And she was a prosecutor, which would be pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Her book was fantastic. I read it when it came out.
Yeah, she also has a great personal story.
And a Yankees fan, so maybe like a 30 for 30 could do it. Maybe ESPN will take it up.
There you go. We'll get Sam on that one, too.
There you go.
So, all right. co-director of the Institute of the Supreme Court of the United States, Carolyn Shapiro, and creator of EmpiricalScotus.com, Adam Feldman. Thanks so much for joining us today, guys.
My pleasure.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Joining us on Legal Face Off, following up on a previous story we had here on the tragic suicide of an MIT student, we are joined by Carolyn Reinach-Wolf, mental health attorney and executive partner at the law firm of Abrams Fensterman. Thank you so much for joining us today, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me.
The Supreme Judicial Court on Monday in a 44-page ruling said that there is no duty to prevent another from committing suicide. In the case, as Ben mentioned, that we've covered, the court said that MIT was not liable in this specific case of a 2009 suicide by one of its students, but it suggested that there could be limited circumstances in which universities could bear some responsibility for protecting their students. Talk to us about this dichotomy between protecting the privacy and individual rights of students with also the need to see red flags and warning signs in these kind of cases where, you know, there's a potential for suicide.
Sure. Well, first of all, the MIT case is limited to that set of facts. And in fact, any of these cases that are brought against colleges and universities really are generally fact specific. So, of course, that decision isn't compelling on other jurisdictions, but it certainly can set a precedent. And in fact, cases over the last several years in different states under different circumstances have actually gone back and forth as to whether there is a duty owed from the university or college to the student or whether there is not. So the law is actually pretty unsettled at this point in terms of a national standard. It's from my experience, we're seeing more and more where schools are going to be held more responsible for students when they are at risk, when the schools fail to follow up on identifying those students who may be at risk and taking follow-up action. And the more that happens, the more my opinion is that the schools will be held responsible. All goes to the issue of notice, how much the school knew or didn't, who brought it to their attention. and whether they initiated some type of intervention but either didn't go far enough or didn't take the proper action.
So do you think that there are more cases like this of suicide? It seems like this is a topic that is definitely getting a lot more attention. Are there more cases of this, or do you think that, and you'd mentioned that you think that the trend is towards schools having more responsibility. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it does happen more than is reported. I think we also don't have reported attempted suicide or suicidal ideation. So we don't really have accurate statistics on exactly what the number is of students who are at risk, as I call them, or exhibiting what I call red flag behavior. You know, on a positive note, there are many students who may attempt suicide or are expressing ideation or thoughts of suicide that don't, in fact, go so far as to carry it out. And it's a smaller number, you know, thankfully, who actually do commit suicide. But we are seeing a trend where those numbers are rising. And more schools are on notice that this is happening on their campuses. And as I said in the Times article, they can't just hide their head in the sand and pretend, you know, if we ignore it, it won't happen or it'll go away, or it won't happen on our campus.
The Times article that you're referring to is from May 12th. Really compelling story, very tragic story, obviously, about a student at Hamilton College who exhibited many warning signs. There was a lot of red flags. I mean, in the days before his suicide, his advisor wrote the academic dean these words: "Obviously, what's happening here is a complete crash and burn. I don't know what the procedures, rules are for contacting parents, but if this was my kid, I'd want to know." It turns out the parents lived only a few hours away. They lived a 5-hour drive away. The mom said, you know, the question that will haunt us forever is, why didn't she call us? The dilemma that a lot of these schools are faced with is the, among other issues, is the FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is a federal law governing student privacy. And that prevents a lot of these universities, at least they claim, in reaching out to parents. Can you talk to us about that law?
Sure. We get asked about this all the time. First of all, it's a complaint-driven law, so there is no legal cause of action under the FERPA law. Secondly, there are exceptions in the law that do provide for a school to be able to notify, whether it's parents or other people on campus, when they are concerned about a student.
In a health or safety emergency is the wording, correct?
Yes. Right. It's a health and safety exception, which all of these laws have, whether it's the HIPAA, healthcare law, state confidentiality laws, all of these laws have health and safety exceptions.
Of course, the question is, what does that mean, right? What is the definition of a health or safety emergency?
Correct. And that's why it also goes to the issue of training and education on campus and having policies and procedures in place so that there are people who are trained to understand when these situations arise and know how to take action. I mean, obviously, you can't know each individual circumstance that may come up, but there is a thread of similarity between them. They've told a roommate. A professor has noticed it in one of their classes that there's a change in behavior. Parents will call the school and say, I haven't heard from my son or daughter in a week, and they always call me on Wednesday evenings, whatever it might be. And that's why we actually work very hard with campuses to initiate behavioral intervention teams or threat assessment teams, as they're called on some campuses. After the Virginia Tech tragedy, more and more schools started using these. They're a multidisciplinary team. They have a reporting system on campus where people to either anonymously or not anonymously, depending on the campus, report into a centralized system saying, I'm concerned about my roommate, I'm concerned about a student in my class, and so on. That team is trained to know how to prioritize the information they're getting and to decide what action to take, whether it's a referral to a counseling center, getting campus law enforcement, going out and taking the student to a hospital. decisions about parental notification. So there are systems that are available to train and educate the team as well as people on campus to identify red flag behaviors, report them in a positive way, and take action. The other issue in all of this is what I like to call playing pick your liability. There has to be a decision made as to maybe we might get sued for a particular scenario or situation, but which side of the potential liability are we going to be on? Are we going to worry about being sued for notifying parents when we have a student who's suicidal, or are we going to be sued for wrongful death? And, you know, I always want to err on the side of breach of confidentiality versus a wrongful death or a serious injury. So there has to be a lot of education and training on our campuses to have that conversation. Not so much, you know, what's the law and let's hide behind it, but let's use a common sense approach to this, and let's use the law in a positive way and use the law with its exceptions, not necessarily, you know, the definition of the law itself.
That's great information. That's Carolyn Reinach-Wolf from the firm of Abrams and Fensterman. Thank you so much for joining us today. For more information, you can visit abramslaw.com. Thanks for being on the show today, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini, and I'm Ben Anderson. Make sure you follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and anywhere else you might find WGN and WGNradio.com. But right now...
MySpace.
Yeah.
We're big on MySpace.
That's my first one. Yeah. I like Friendster myself, yes. but yeah, that works. Joining us on the phone right now, we have State Representative Lou Lang. Thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me with you.
So, Representative, you've fought for economic development, working families, health care, marijuana, and civil rights. And you also happen to be a major proponent of ratification in Illinois of the Equal Rights Amendment. Where are we currently with regard to ratifying this in Illinois from a procedural perspective, and why is it so important?
Well, first, let me say that it requires 38 states to make the Equal Rights Amendment part of the federal constitution. As of recently, when Nevada ratified it, they were the 36th state, so Illinois could be 37, and then one more state, women will have the rights they should be due under the federal constitution. I've been working on this long time because I'm a longtime proponent of fairness and equal rights and equal justice, and there are certainly all sorts of instances in this country where women haven't been given the respect and the equal opportunity they should be due. Laws alone have not done it, and so we need to enshrine women in the federal constitution. We're close to making it happen in Illinois. We're a few votes away, working on those people diligently to try to get their votes. And this is going to be up for a committee hearing on tomorrow, Wednesday morning, and hopefully we'll move it to the floor for a vote.
Representative, we're now in a whole different era, of course, in the wake of the Me Too movement than we were when the deadline to pass the ERA came and went in 1982. Why do you think now's the right time?
It's always been the right time. In fact, I opened the last committee hearing by saying it's never too late to provide women the rights they ought to be due under the federal Constitution. You know, when the federal Constitution was written by our founding fathers, they were brilliant men, but they were all men. And at that time, women were considered equal partners in government, equal partners in economic justice. Today they are. But our laws are not sufficient to protect them. And Supreme Court justice is as far distant in political philosophy as Antonin Scalia, unfortunately the late justice, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Both have said that women are not protected under the federal Constitution. And there are a lot of red herrings brought forth as to why people would want to vote no on this, all sorts of scare stories. But in the end, one question remains. Are women equal citizens of this country, or are they not? And should they be given rights under the federal Constitution of equality and justice or not? And that's a decision that members will have to make when we bring this to the floor for a vote.
So let's talk a little bit more about those folks that are objecting to this and the basis on which they're objecting. I mean, I'm a woman. I believe in equal rights. I would think the vast majority of women out there would. But why don't you walk our listeners through the bases on which people are objecting to this?
First thing they say is they think it's an avenue to government-paid abortions. And, of course, there's nothing in the Equal Rights Amendment that talks about abortion, nothing in the Equal Rights Amendment that says anything about paying for anybody's health care. The Equal Rights Amendment simply says the government can't discriminate against people on the basis of their gender, of their sex. So all of these wild accusations about abortion are wrong. In fact, the Illinois Constitution has had equal rights language in it since 1970, and there's never been a court case on the issue. There's never been anybody who has demanded payment for any health care service that they weren't getting based on the equal rights language in our Constitution. Then they go on to talk about all sorts of other things, high school and college athletics, which is just nonsense. They talk about the fact that the federal deadline has come and gone, but the federal deadline was just a ministerial date. In fact, Congress changed that date once. They could change it again or not. The Supreme Court may have to determine whether the deadline has meaning or not. It's not for us to determine that here in the Illinois State Legislature. And they talk about all sorts of other red herrings, but none of them cross the line of convincing any normal and rational person that women should not be due rights under the federal Constitution. Imagine if we said, well, then let's take other people's rights out of the Constitution. Let's take gun owners' rights out of the Constitution. Let's take the rights of racial equality out of the federal Constitution. Of course, nobody would do that. And yet, people don't want to put women into the United States Constitution because all these various made-up stories about all the horror stories that will happen if we do it. Those horror stories have not happened in the state of Illinois, and they will not happen in the federal government either.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Representative Lang. That's one more time, RepLouLang.com for everything about the representative that you need to know. And thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off today.
It was my pleasure. Have a great day.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off here on WGN and WGNRadio.com. With us now is David Sussler, co-author of Inside Out, Leaving a Legacy. Rich, I believe we know the other co-author as well. Is that correct?
We might, yeah. This is our Inside Out segment with two of our favorite people from Chicago Lawyer Magazine. David Sussler, as you mentioned, is Associate General Counsel with National Material and also co-author of this column with Christina Martini, who we might know. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Haven't seen you in a long time.
Right. So your column in March 2018, which can be found on chicagolawyer.com.
Chicagolawyermagazine.com.
Chicagolawyermagazine.com. You would think after 4 years I would remember this.
You would never find it if you just look at chicagolawyer.com.
Yeah, so chicagolawyermagazine.com. This month is Leaving a Legacy, How to Make a Difference Long After You're Gone, which I have to say is a little morbid. It's a little, maybe a little depressed, Sussler, but the underlying message is, You should be not only accomplishing your goals that are directly in front of you as the lawyer, but trying to create a legacy, trying to leave something that others can benefit from as you progress in your career and your life. Yes, David, first?
Yeah, I think...
Why is that important?
I would like to leave a positive difference. Why is it important? Well, you know, as I say in the column, for those of us who became lawyers to try to make a positive difference, we'd like to know that we actually succeeded in that. Number one. Number two, you know, we don't want to toil away in vain without making a positive difference after all those years.
All right. It's interesting because you talk about making a difference. And we recently, last episode, we had on someone talking about whether corporations have rights. Tina, you work for a law firm, outside counsel. You represent many large corporations, many large clients. Isn't your main responsibility as an attorney delivering a product to your clients, and David, same point in-house, to provide legal services that help these companies thrive successfully? Why is it also important to give back, as David is referencing, and create a legacy? In other words, is it your only responsibility to achieve your goals of providing a quality legal service to your clients?
Well, that's obviously the number one priority, is to make sure that the deliverable to the client is what they want and then some. But when you look at the context in which legal services are rendered, it's not just about giving a deliverable to a client. It's also about forging new relationships, expanding upon existing relationships. And with those relationships comes a bunch of different facets. You know, a great example is we do pro bono with some of our clients in addition to just doing billable work for them. We make introductions to them. We help them push their business forward in whatever way we are able to as outside counsel. And I would say that is an important part of leaving an imprint and leaving a legacy vis-a-vis a client.
David.
Yeah, I agree, and I want to add a little bit on that, because you know our number one job is to provide the legal representation that our client asks for, but it's bigger than that. You know, for example, if you have a labor and employment issue going on at the firm, let's say you're having trouble retaining employees, you can counsel your client how to do a better job at retaining your employees. You can help your clients create an overall positive workplace, and you leave a legacy by having improved the working lives of many people, as well as improve your company's or your client's performance. So you do both, give a legal answer and create a positive legacy.
Tina, we've often covered on Legal Face-Off the perception that lawyers are greedy, that they don't care about others, that it's one of the consistently rated the one of the professions that people distrust the most. Is it harder for an attorney, given those perceptions, to create a legacy versus other professions?
I don't think so. I think that actually when you look at what a lawyer does, they represent clients, they provide legal service, particularly for those who are not able to represent themselves. So I think that you get people who are greedy and who are only out for themselves pretty much in every profession. And unfortunately, lawyers suffer the same bad rap that others do. But I actually think being a lawyer is a great opportunity to leave a legacy, because there's so many different buckets in which you can leave a legacy. As I mentioned before, with respect to clients in the context of the client relationship and the value adds and the different facets that come along with that. But also, as for me, for example, as an attorney in private practice, being able to, for example, play a meaningful role in recruiting talent. You know, that is the real essence of what making a difference and leaving an imprint and leaving a legacy is through the people you recruit and who you train and who are the folks that you sort of pass the baton to as the next generation. I mean, that's one example. Another example is trying to implement and design systems and processes that help the business aspect of where you work be better and more streamlined and more efficient for those who come along after you. So those are just two examples.
David, quickly picking up on that point, you have helped run the Association of Corporate Counsel. the Chicago chapter's diversity summer internship program for almost 15 years. You've served on the Posse Foundation, their leadership council for over 8 years. How do you counsel young people and specifically young attorneys to begin to develop a legacy?
Well, you know,
I almost stumped Sussler on that one. Well, that was the longest pause in Sussler's history.
I tell you, well, I have to think about it.
Good question, right? A little props to the question, Sussler, maybe.
One of the specific things I do, for example, is I will talk to young lawyers about personal branding, you know, creating your personal brand and what does that mean, and talk to them, say, hey, start thinking about it now. What's the impression you want to create in others? What do you want others to think of you? How do you want others to think of you? To think of, you know, what is the impression you want to create for others? And that's one way. Just think about how you present yourself to the world and always be your best. And tell them, you know, look, it's not just great work product. You have to be the whole package.
All right. It would not be an Inside Out column if it ain't both mock Sussler in some way and also talk about Bruce Springsteen. So we'll get the first one out of the way. This is actually not mockery. I asked Tina, who is your co-author on Inside Out, whether the jacket you're wearing in the headshot has matching pants or if it's just the top. I think it's very fashion forward. Yeah. And then she said, you might not be wearing, we don't want to go down that route at all. But my second question is, speaking of legacies, what legacy? I often think as a huge Bruce Springsteen fan that, you know, his time in the spotlight is nearing the twilight. I mean, he's, you know, he's an older gentleman. He's still obviously rocking as hard as he ever has. But, you know, we'll see a time when he will wind down. How do you both view Bruce Springsteen's legacy in the history of the art that he is so proficient at? Tina, you're a Springsteen fan?
I am a Springsteen fan.
What's his legacy?
I mean, I think his legacy is multifaceted. I think it's as a musician. I think it's as really as a storyteller more than anything. I mean, he's got such an incredible body of work. I look back on some of my favorite albums, including Tunnel of Love. And the fact that that came out in 1987, I was actually working in a record store when it came out and thinking at the time, what a wonderfully poignant, painful story he tells with that album. And I think that he brings comfort and solace to people as well as a lot of joy. And I think that is a legacy. His music is timeless. You can listen to things that are 30 plus years old and it sounds like it's still vibrant and contemporary.
That's why you have a Tina Martini. Look at that. That was incredible. Sussler, good luck following up on that one.
Yeah, man.
What do you got?
Can't I just say ditto?
Yeah. If you cite to the lyrics of Backstreets, then you're disqualified.
Okay, I'm not going to do that. I agree that I think his legacy is really as a songwriter and a storyteller, and that the beauty of his songwriting is he doesn't just chronicle people and the American condition and people's lives and struggles within our society. One of the brilliant things about his writing is that it can be viewed and interpreted from so many different angles. And then, you know, there's the one part is just the literature of his songs. The other part is the music. And the guy has such an ability to write kind of a sad or deep or even depressing story with such joyful music that he just lifts your spirit. And for me personally, listening to his music has gotten me through some very, very rough moments in life. Certainly like getting through finals during law school and the bar exam, just turn on a particular Springsteen song and it boosts my spirits. So that's one of his many multifaceted legacies.
David, someday we'll look back on this and it will all seem funny. That's all I have to say to that.
I'll take it.
All right. David Sussler, co-author with the other half of Sustini, Tina Martini. Inside Out, Leaving a Legacy. It's really a fantastic article. If you get the chance, check it out. ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com. Thanks so much for joining the show today, David.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Sussler.
Bye.
Bring home milk.
Hey.
As always, we close things out on with our legal grab bag, and today we have seven topics spanning the legal spectrum, starting with a topic that I wish Sam could be here longer for because he can talk a long time about it, but the Supreme Court's decision to legalize sports betting. Sam, what do you have to say today?
Well, this has been a battle that's been going on for 6 years, Benny. You know, it started back in 2012. Ray Lesniak was the senator that initially wanted to push it across, then Chris Christie got on board. So this thing has accelerated time and time again, and they had to deal with so much rejection, honestly. There were, you know, points in this case where they thought about pulling the pin because they got tired of all the rejections. They got rejected in New Jersey. They got rejected in New Jersey again. They got rejected in New Jersey again. Then they take it to the Supreme Court. Got rejected, and then, you know, they made the appeal, and when the Supreme Court eventually decided to take the appeal, that was actually the green light, and we got word yesterday, I got the phone call on Monday about 7 a.m., get into work, because this thing is happening. So what it means is pretty much that PASPA law, which went in 1992, that said that, you know, the federal ban on sports was cool, they said that was unconstitutional. So now, on a state-by-state basis, every state will have the option to implement sports gaming. There are so many things that are yet to be determined. There are so many questions that I still have, and I've been doing all these radio and television ads. People want to know everything about this, and there are so many things that are still waiting to be, you know, decided. But as far as I know with Illinois, and that's what our listeners care about, in Illinois I talked to a couple of state reps and senators yesterday, and they believe that this bill will be passed. Now, it's been introduced, but it hasn't been passed. They think it'll be passed by early session 2019, around January. And then I was also told once it's passed, it might only take 6 months to get this thing in order. And people believe in the Senate, in the House of Representatives in Illinois, that you can bet in Chicago and in Illinois in July of 2019.
So there's so many questions we have, Sammy, and we're really thrilled to have you here today. And unfortunately, this is just for the grab bag, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more as it unfolds. But one of the things that people have asked about is how the integrity fee would work. Could you take a few seconds to explain that aspect of it?
So, Tina, the integrity fee is what the leagues want. The leagues want a piece of the pie, which is ironic because, as you know, and I'm sure as you've read, the leagues have been fighting sports betting forever. They think it's bad. They think it's, you know, it affects their product. They're worried about people fixing games. But now all of a sudden, they realize that it makes money, and now they want a cut of it. So they want a 1% cut of every dollar wagered on professional sports. The problem with that is, and what I've been able to learn here in my time in Vegas, is that a sports book only realizes 5% of $100. So when the leagues ask for $1 out of 100, they think that's 1%. That math is so far off, Tina, it's ridiculous, because the sports book, of that $100, of every $100, they only keep 5. So that wow. One is not of 100, that one is out of 5. It's not 1%, it's 20%. So these leagues are so far off, and Vegas doesn't pay an integrity fee. They never have, and they never will. And New Jersey, as far as we can gather here at VSiN, New Jersey's not going to go to bed with the leagues either. They're not going to even give the league anything. So, you know, it might be good for some states to have the leagues, you know, in peace and give that percentage, but it won't be 1%. I think it'd be closer to, you know, 0.25 or 0.30, but they'll never get 1% because you can't make money. You can't operate a sports book giving away 1% of every wager.
So what does this mean for the black market? Another topic that's been hotly discussed since this decision came down. Obviously, the black market is tied to billions of dollars. What do you think this decision is going to mean for the black market?
That's a good question, honestly. The estimated reports that annually the illegal markets around the country, just in America, like illegal bookies, corner bookies, make about $150 to $200 billion. Billion, not million, billion. So I don't think you can cut too much into that. And also, Gina, if you're going to have these books have to pay an integrity fee, the price on making bets legally will increase. So instead of paying $55 to win $50, to do it legally, I might have to pay then, with that integrity fee, $60 or $65 to win $50. So where am I going to bet it? Am I going to risk $65 legally, or am I going to risk $55 illegally? That's a simple question. You know that answer. If I'm doing this to make money, I'm going to do it where I can, you know, cost accordingly.
Right.
So the black market will always have an edge because they can always offer what they want to offer, which is minus 110, you know, 10% juice. And also, let's be real about it, corner bookies do it on a credit-based purpose. They you know, you give them your word and you worry about your debt when it's all said and done. So I've talked to some bookies. I know some bookies. They're not really worried. Okay, maybe they lose a couple of customers, but at the end of the day, you get the price that you're always going to get. And if you lose X amount of dollars, you keep betting, and then you figure it out at the end of the day. Whereas legally, you have to put the money down up front, right? You have to put the money on the counter. You get a ticket. With the black market, it's all credit-based, and that's how people get in trouble.
So, Sammy, unfortunately, we have to wind up our time here to talking about this. But is there anything else you'd like to share with folks before you sign off?
Well, I just think, honestly, you know, Tina, this is super huge, because when you think about what people said about Las Vegas for years, you know, when other casinos opened up around the country, people said Las Vegas will dry up, right? Las Vegas won't be able to hang anymore, but Vegas is still king. And that was the question that I was asked so many times yesterday. How will this affect Las Vegas? And I don't think it really puts much of a dent at all, because people still come to Vegas for everything else. They come for attractions and shows and events and restaurants and clubs and parties. And the sportsbook, really, in every casino, maybe they make 2-4% of the bottom line. It's all about the slots and the blackjack and the roulette and the craps and the baccarat. That's where the money's at. So sports betting in Vegas is such a little piece of the pie that Vegas, I promise you, will be okay.
You're speaking like a true resident of Las Vegas, Sam. It didn't take very long.
Yeah, you were my reason to go out there. So now I will have to see with all this betting. I might have to do all my bets here now, buddy.
You know, we have to do Legal Face-Off live from Vegas. We have to do an episode, so let's get on that.
Yes,
so
we
in.
Do.
I'm so
well,
in.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you in our next episode, Sammy.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right. Hollywood docket. Settlement for Jay-Z's Roc Nation to result in Prince album release.
Yeah, so it's hard to believe that we have just celebrated the second anniversary of Prince's untimely death. And since 2016, there's been a lot of drama and intrigue, not only surrounding the circumstances of his death, which we recently covered on Legal Face-Off, but also regarding the rights to various aspects of his estate, including the right to release and distribute his music, both that which was previously released when he was alive, as well as new music that up until now no one has heard. Back in 2016, the administrator of Prince's estate authorized NPG Records to file a lawsuit against Jay-Z's Roc Nation after 15 of Prince's albums were put on Tidal, which is a streaming service that is substantially owned by Roc Nation. Roc Nation claimed that it had a license to do so, while Prince's estate alleged that one of the purported license agreements may have actually been fabricated. So over recent weeks, the parties have filed extensions in the case to talk settlement, while also seeking input from the probate court in Minnesota. A deal was struck last week between the parties where they agreed to the release of a new full-length album of previously unreleased material from Prince's vault. And that material is scheduled to be released sometime in 2019. So, Ben, are you a Prince fan?
I am.
What is your favorite Prince song? It's quite a catalog to choose from.
I'd have to go with Let's Go Crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know I've said it before on Legal Face-Off, and I will stick by this answer. It's my final answer, Little Red Corvette.
It's a solid choice.
It's a classic, and I'm very sad that I still miss him. I think he was incredibly influential on music, and it's hard to believe that when I think back to high school, that was over 30 years ago now, that he really started hitting the mainstream. So I'm really looking forward to hearing these new releases that apparently are in the pipeline.
I am too. All right, Rich, a federal judge accepts guilty pleas from lawyers in $4 million phony billing scheme. What do you have to tell
me
about
that? We've seen and covered on this show some bad billing practices. This takes the
of various sorts.
Yikes. Yeah, two Michigan lawyers are no longer practicing. A federal judge accepted their guilty pleas last month in a $4 million phony billing scheme. These attorneys, who were former classmates of Michigan State in the 80s, pled guilty to two counts of wire fraud. I mean, interestingly, wire fraud, I think, was only $150,000, mm-hmm, of the $4 million that was in the wire fraud count. But I guess they took what they could get. There was a scheme for these two attorneys One was in Milwaukee, in-house at a company. The other was outside counsel. Not inside out, but
yeah,
a whole different set of inside.
Sussler and I do not have these kinds of schemes, okay?
So the one in-house lawyer would create an invoice for work that was done by the outside counsel's firm, but was actually done on his own in-house or by other attorneys in-house. He would approve the invoices. His company paid the invoices to this outside firm. This is my favorite part. Then when the outside attorney received the money for work that he never did, he would deliver 2/3 of it to the inside counsel's home in Wisconsin.
It's amazing. How many people do you think are going to copy this scheme?
And then he took the money, invested it in his personal bank account. He used it for the stock market and also to buy guns worth tens of thousands of dollars.
Why couldn't he buy a boat instead?
Yeah, and just go off somewhere. His firm made at least almost $5 million as a result of the phony invoices, according to the plea agreements. This began in 2000 and continued until they discovered it in 2015. So almost $5 million over the course of 15 years. Unbelievable. I wonder, I don't know if it said how much time they're getting. I mean, there's obviously their licenses are suspended.
Suspended? They should be disbarred.
Yeah, they resigned, but... Yeah, I mean, hopefully they're facing jail time for this, but just bananas what goes on sometimes in the legal world, Christina.
You cannot make these things
up. Cannot.
All right. ABA should never have accredited now closed Charlotte School of Law lawsuit claims.
Yes. So a former professor and a former student from the Charlotte School of Law have both sued the ABA, accusing it of negligence in accrediting the now closed law school. Charlotte graduate Essie Love and the former professor of Charlotte Law School, Barbara Bernier, claim that the ABA section of legal education at admissions to the bar knew or should have known that the law school was not complying with accreditation standards. The lawsuit alleges that this in turn misled both plaintiffs into joining the school that they allege was focused more on profit than on legal education. The law school ended up closing last year after it lost its state license amidst allegations that it was not complying with basic admission standards as well as federal student aid laws. The complaint alleges that the law school and the consortium of for-profit schools of which it was a part, which is called InfoLaw, intentionally admitted students with poor academic performance and low LSAT scores in order to maximize the total number of students who were paying tuition. The suit further alleges that when students were preparing to take the bar exam, they were discouraged by the school and sometimes were even paid to skip the exam if there were concerns that the students would fail it. They would then be counted as second-time test takers when they eventually did take the bar, which allegedly would prevent their scores from being reported. The suit also claims that the law school hired graduates for what were termed meaningless jobs to artificially inflate employment rates. The plaintiffs also allege that the ABA's accreditation of the school helped in this process by making it possible for students of the law school to take out federal student loans. The suit states that the ABA knew or should have known that the school was not compliant with accreditation standards and that the ABA repeatedly ignored signs of noncompliance. There are also allegations that the school and the consortium knowingly defrauded the federal government by failing to disclose its noncompliance with federal student loan laws. So, Ben, as you mentioned, the Charlotte School of Law closed its doors, and that was back in August, because it lost its license, and the ABA then pulled its accreditation in February. And there are actually a number of additional former students who are suing the school separately. So it's very sad, but there's, you know, been quite a bit of controversy over the past couple of years about various schools and the conditions under which they've been opened, allegations, particularly when they are not accredited or when there are contentions that the quality of the school and the employment rates and so forth indicate that the school may not be as comparable quality as some other schools. So it'll be interesting to see if we see more of this.
I agree, and I'm very interested to see where that goes. All right, the next topic up, I just think stinks.
Well, apparently a lot of other people thought it stunk too. So this is a fun story about a smelly hog farm. Oh, wait, let's do that over again. This is a fun story about a smelly hog farm. So a federal judge in North Carolina has slashed what was a $50 million punitive damages award in a nuisance suit that was filed against pork producer Murphy Brown, which is a division of Smithfield Foods. In this lawsuit, the 15,000 head hog farm, I can't even say this. In this lawsuit, the 15,000 head hog farm that stored the animal waste in open air lagoons and sprayed it on nearby fields was accused of creating a stench that was so foul that the plaintiffs claim the stench remained in their clothes, attracted clouds of flies, and coated their homes and cars with liquid waste. U.S. District Judge Earl Britt ruled in November that the state's right to farm law did not apply because the plaintiffs and their relatives lived on their property before the hog farm began its operations. As a result, along with compensatory damages, the 10 plaintiffs in the suit will each collect a total of $325,000. This award includes a limit of punitive damages to $250,000 per plaintiff. It's interesting that North Carolina lawmakers have since changed the state's nuisance law to make these types of lawsuits more difficult. The legislature has also enacted a cap on compensatory damages, and that was back in 2017, but this measure is not retroactive. What's interesting is that this is a case that is the first in a series of nuisance trials that have been filed against Murphy Brown. Not to be confused with the show Murphy Brown. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of this and these additional lawsuits.
I can't.
Do you want to go to North Carolina and check out the hog farm?
I'm just amazed that you could do something like that. I live downwind from an LA Fitness, and with people coming out of there, it makes me wonder if I have a case.
So. I don't know. I mean, I can't say I've ever lived downwind from an LA Fitness, but I can only imagine, especially on a windy day in Chicago.
Yeah. All right. Another topic from the Southeast. University of Virginia School of Law to receive $43.9 million donation from two alumni.
Yeah, on a more positive note, one of the co-owners of the Golden State Warriors, who are up, 1-0 against Houston in the Western Conference Finals, if Sam was here,
he'd be talking all about it
for this one. He's also the co-founder of Oak Tree Capital, and they threw a bunch of money at their law school. UVA is going to get a $43.9 million donation. It includes $18.9 million in matching funds from the Board of Visitors in their name. It will provide 3-year tuition and fee scholarships for law students, and also the Karsh Center. The alumni's name is Karsh. Karsh Center for Law and Democracy. It's great. You know, very, very obviously philanthropic. But does UVA need more money? How about like NIU? How about Northern Illinois getting some of this money?
And there he goes, Lankhoff, Mr. fucking Karsh. NIU.
I mean, UVA is what, ranked at least 7th or 8th in the country?
Yeah,
right now?
It's definitely top 10. And
get richer, Christine Martini.
Well, I'm wondering. You know, it's funny. I read the story, and I thought of how J.B. Pritzker donated a bunch of money to Northwestern. So is UVA going to change its name now? Like Northwestern has now, Northwestern Pritzker School.
Yeah, maybe
of Law?
A statue of Karsh instead of that Thomas Jefferson character who's all over.
Yeah, who is
Charlottesville?
That guy?
Who needs him?
All right,
Ben. That big pause is your cue to jump in.
You guys were on a roll. I didn't. You know, I get mesmerized sometimes when you guys get going.
Yes.
Yeah, we mesmerize ourselves.
All right, so the final topic, I feel, could have been the alternate ending we all wanted to Planet of the Apes. But chimpanzees lose habeas bid in New York's top court. A judge sees a manifest injustice.
Yes, so here on Legal Face-Off, as Rich likes to know, we talk about primates, not quite on
We're on the cutting edge of monkey law on the show. There's no show or podcast that covers primates, legislation, and jurisprudence more than legal face-offs.
Well, we're not talking about actual primates. We talk about the band, the monkeys.
Yes, that's right.
And the various members and how I had a crush on Davy Jones. But that's for another day. So... last but not least, the New York Supreme Court recently refused to hear a habeas appeal filed on behalf of two caged chimpanzees. The cases were filed on the chimpanzees' behalf by the Non-Human Rights Project of Coral Gables, Florida. The appellate court ruled last year that the suits filed on behalf of the chimpanzees, known as Tommy and Kiko, were successive habeas proceedings and therefore could not succeed because they were not supported by changed circumstances. The new expert testimony did not refute previous findings that the chimpanzees don't have any legal duties and therefore have no legal rights. The appellate court based its conclusion on the premise that a chimpanzee is not a member of the human species. Rich, do you have any thoughts on that?
I disagree.
I think we all disagree, especially after you watch Planet of the Apes. So in discussing the court's decision, the concurring judge, Eugene Fahey, said some things that actually some people believe could be very important to primate jurisprudence. I hear Rich's sound effects.
Hold on. You know what I'm looking for. Keep going.
Oh,
don't let me interfere.
So Judge Fahey said that while a chimpanzee is not a person entitled to habeas relief, he or she may nevertheless still have a right to liberty that is protected by habeas corpus. Fahey went on to state that whether a being has the right to seek release from confinement through habeas corpus should not be treated as an either-or scenario. He cited evidence that chimpanzees have advanced cognitive abilities of many different kinds, including being able to remember things from the past, to plan for the future. They have self-awareness and self-control, while a lot of my friends and people I know don't, so I guess that's a leg up, as well as an ability to communicate. They also have other human-like qualities, including being able to recognize themselves in mirrors and in photographs and TV images. They're able to imitate others and to exhibit emotions such as compassion and depression. He went further to state that chimpanzees and humans exist on a continuum of living beings and that chimpanzees share almost all of their DNA with humans. So while a chimp may not technically be a person, there is still no doubt that a chimp is more than just a thing. So an attorney who was with the Non-Human Rights Project that represented the chimps said that he thinks that this opinion may very well be a historical turning point in the struggle to obtain legal rights for non-human animals in the U.S.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape! That's my favorite line from Planet
Roddy.
Of the Apes.
Oh, it's Roddy.
It's, no, that's, the best.
That's not Roddy.
That's Heston.
Oh, that's Heston.
Yeah. Roddy was an ape.
Yeah. That's right. I forgot. Sorry, yeah. I had a brain cramp there.
One of the top five ending scenes of any film in movie history.
Yeah,
not as a spoiler to any of our listeners, but Tina's looking at me quizzically. You know, the last scene in Planet of the Apes,
yes.
He's riding on horseback.
Yes.
He thinks they're off the planet, and then he sees the Statue of Liberty in the sand and realizes that they've been on the planet Earth the entire time.
Yes.
Yeah. Great ending. One of
Great
my favorite
ending.
Movies. Favorite monkey movie, Tina? There's many, by the way.
This is the monkeys with Davy Jones.
Come on. You got Mighty Joe Young. You got Rampage.
Congo.
Just came out. Congo's a good one. You
King,
got
King Kong. I mean, King
I
Kong.
I love the original
out
King
of Africa.
Kongs. The original King Kong movies from the 1930s. What you cannot beat those.
The new one is good, though. Skull Island?
I have not seen
still,
it.
Yeah, I
very good.
Seen that one.
What about what was that one with Matthew Broderick? War Games. Remember, there's a monkey in War Games.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. That was a great movie.
Yeah.
I'm a
lot
big
of bad
Broderick
monkey
fan.
Movies, too, though.
What? Come on, Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Why
Every
am I going
which
blank?
Way but loose.
Thank you.
And any which way you can, the sequel. Yeah.
And then, of course, you put a monkey in a movie.
Oh,
it's gold.
Forget it, man. It's like printing it's money.
Yeah.
BJ and the Bear. Remember BJ and the Bear?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yep.
With Greg Evigan.
Wow.
Played BJ.
Wow.
And the bear was his monkey. A direct ripoff of the Clint Eastwood movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's really impressive.
Yeah. Hang on one second. Let's go back to whether our chimpanzee agrees. Yes, he agrees. That's him saying, stay tuned for the next episode of Legal Face-Off.
You know what we should do? We should listen to Every Which Way But Loose. That's a great song.
Every Which Way But Loose. Sung by Clint Eastwood.
No.
Over the closing credits of the film.
Get out. Yeah. Really?
Any Which Way But Loose. Yep.
That was such a great
written
song.
Written and performed by Clint Eastwood.
Love that song.
All haven't right.
heard it in about 30 years.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of Legal Face-Off. Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini, and Ben Anderson filling in for Sam Panayanovich. I hope he's doing well in the land of sunshine
Sam,
and legalized
the monkey
gambling.
Of our show, Sam Panayanovich.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.